You are listening to the podcast of Providence Church in Austin, Texas. We hope this message raises your affections for Jesus and helps you live out the gospel in everyday life.
I was thinking this week, we Christians have a long history of, we like to come up with pithy little statements or illustrations that sort of summarize a larger theological truth. And I was an example of this is a phrase that I was thinking about this week that people used to say a lot, and I probably said this embarrassingly, something like this at some point to someone in my life, and it was like this: going to church doesn't make you a Christian any more than going to McDonald's makes you a hamburger. Right? I'm kind of like, oh, I'll have to ponder that. There's a lot of profound wisdom there, probably. Or we would say something like, going to church doesn't make you a Christian any more than driving into a garage makes you a car. Right? And what we were saying in those statements, and what we're really trying to say, is that external religious activities are not what makes someone a Christian, like going to church, but it's an internal change of the heart through faith in Jesus. Now, here's the problem, though, with pithy little statements like that. They tend to overcorrect. Like, in their drive to correct one theological error, sometimes they end up making another theological error. So, the idea that going to church doesn't make you a Christian can quickly get twisted into Christians don't need to go to church, right? And this created a whole way of thinking about Christianity that sort of minimized or marginalized the worship of the church. And you begin to hear things like, well, I've got my own private spirituality. Or, I like Jesus, I just don't really like his people, don't really want to be around them much, so I'm not into the organized religion thing. I worship God in my own way, in my own time. But as you read the Bible, this has never been the norm for how God's people worship. The worship of God has never been primarily individualistic. It's never been primarily private. Now, as we've been working our way through the book of Exodus, we've discovered that the primary reason that God brought Israel out of Egypt was to worship, right? Again and again and again in the first few chapters of Exodus, we see it said that God says to Pharaoh, let my people go that they may worship me in the wilderness. Let my people go, let my people go that they may worship me. So the main reason he set them free from Egypt was so that they might become worshipers, so that worshiping Yahweh would be the central purpose of their very lives. Last week we saw, though, that God had something very particular in mind about what that worship would look like, and that is that he wanted to give them a place of worship. He wanted to give them this tabernacle, this elaborate, beautiful tent that would be their place of worship, and that this would be where he would meet with them, where he would dwell among them, because he had been meeting them on Mount Sinai. Remember, that's where we've been in the story. That's where he gave them the law, the Ten Commandments, but they're leaving there. They're going off on their journey to the Promised Land, and God's saying, I'm not staying on Mount Sinai. I'm going with y'all. And so he says, I'm going to give you a little portable Mount Sinai, a little portable, mobile, holy place, a little portable, mobile, holy place of worship in the tabernacle, and that's where I will meet with you along the way. And so he gave them this very detailed pattern, this detailed blueprint about how to construct the tabernacle. One third of the book of Exodus is focused on the tabernacle and this intricate, detailed construction project. Isn't that interesting? One third, 13 out of the 40 chapters in Exodus are focused on the tabernacle. And this is usually the section of Exodus where we just go to sleep, right? Because it's so boring, or we stop reading, or we skip ahead, and we think, I'm just going to read Leviticus now, because that's going to be a lot more exciting. And then we just skip ahead. It was like, well, can I get to the New Testament now? But it's one third of the book, so we ought not skip ahead. We ought to, because it's important that it's there. And so we're actually, this is the second week we're spending in this section about the tabernacle. It's hugely important because in the tabernacle, God provides a place of grace. It's a place that God would condescend and dwell amongst his people. It's a place where the unapproachable God would make himself accessible. It's a place where the universal God, think about this, would make himself local, right? And so what we learned last week is that worship is local, right? right? It has a locale. It has a place. We worship God on grounds that we could understand. But there's a second thing that we see in this tabernacle section of Exodus. We also see that worship is communal, meaning it's shared by a particular people. So worship not only involves a place, it involves an us, right? And today we're going to talk about the us of worship, the people of worship. And I want you to see in this text three things about the worshiping community. I want you to see the gifts of the people, the attitude of the people, and then the deepest need of the people, all right? The gifts, the attitude, and then the deepest need of the people. Let's look at the gifts of the people first. Look over at Exodus 25. God is the one who has initiated this tabernacle project, but the cool thing is he brings it to fruition through the gifts of his people. In other words, God is always the prime mover in worship, and yet he brings it about. He allows his people to be contributors in his worship. And I want you to notice a few things about their gifts, the gifts of the people here. First is that they give both their treasures and their talents to the worship of God. Chapter 25, verse 1. The Lord said to Moses, "Speak to the people of Israel that they may take from me a contribution from every man whose heart moves him. You shall receive the contribution for me. And this is the contribution that you shall receive from them." Listen to how valuable this stuff is. Gold, silver, bronze, blue and purple and scarlet yarn. So you've got fine metals, and then you've got fine material, fine twine linen, goat's hair, tan ram skins, goat skins. Goat skin is really, this is a goat skin Bible. Really nice stuff, right? This is a fine piece of material right here. This is what the people are giving. Acacia wood, oil for the lamps, spices for the anointing oil and for the fragrant incense, onyx stones and stones. So fine jewels they're giving. This is not stuff that desert dwellers would just have laying around in abundance. This is the finest stuff that they have. Look over at chapter 35, over to the right a little bit, verse 22. Chapter 35, verse 22. So they came, both men and women, all who were of a willing heart, and they brought brooches and earrings and signet rings and armlets, all sorts of gold objects, every man dedicating an offering of gold to the Lord, and everyone who possessed blue or purple or scarlet yarns or fine linen or goat's hair or tan ram skins or goat skins, they brought them. The people of Israel were not going through their closets to find the rattiest clothes that they had to give to Goodwill, right? The ones with holes in them that they hadn't worn in 5 years. They were giving their best stuff. They were giving their treasure in the truest sense of the word. But that's not all they give. They also give their talents. Look over in chapter 35, verse 25. It says, "Every skillful woman spun with her hands." Verse 26, "All the women whose hearts stirred them to use their skill spun the goat's hair." Chapter 36, verse 1, "Bezalel and Aholiab and every craftsman in whom the Lord has put skill and intelligence to know how to do any work in the construction of the sanctuary shall work in accordance with all that the Lord has commanded." And so they're not just giving, they're just not writing checks here, right? They're not just giving material things. They're giving of themselves, their abilities, their skill, their effort, their time. And I want you to notice that everyone contributes. I mean, if you look in chapter 35, starting in verse, I don't know, about 21, notice how many times it says all and every here. Verse 21, "And they came, everyone whose heart stirred him and everyone whose spirit moved him." Verse 22, "So they came, both men and women, all who were of a willing heart." Verse 23, "And everyone who possessed blue or purple or scarlet." Verse 24, "Everyone who could make a contribution." Verse 25, "And every skillful woman." Verse 26, "All the women." Verse 29, "All the men and the women and the people of Israel." Everyone is involved here. Nobody is a spectator. Nobody's on the sidelines. Everyone is bringing their gifts to this project, and everyone is needed. Now, here's the cool thing. Everything that the people give to God here is actually from God, right? Because how did these desert dwellers who were former slaves, how is it that they had all this finery, these really valuable things to give to God? Because God had given it to them. Remember the night of the Exodus? In chapter 12, when they went out of Egypt, God said, "Hey, ask the Egyptians for gold and for silver and for clothes and a bunch of stuff." And they do. And it says that in chapter 12, it says God gave them favor with the Egyptians, and the Egyptians gave them what they asked for. And so they plundered the Egyptians. They went out of Egypt wealthy people because God gave it to them. Now, how did they get all these skills and abilities and talents? Aren't they just brickmakers who've been slaves their whole lives? Well, according to this, God gave them this skill. Look at verse 30 in chapter 35. Then Moses said to the people of Israel, "See, the Lord has called by name Bezalel, the son of Uri, son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah, and he has filled him with the Spirit of God." What does it look like for Bezalel to be filled with the Spirit? He's got skill, he's got intelligence, he's got knowledge, and he's got all kinds of craftsmanship. And he calls others who are similarly gifted by the Spirit of God to do these things. All the skill and talent that they have is given to them by God. So in this text, God is calling everyone in the community to contribute to the worship of himself by giving their treasure, by giving their talent, and he's already provided them with everything they need for it. Isn't that amazing? It's this wonderful circle. God gives to them, then they give it back to God. God gives to them, and they give it back to God. They're simply stewarding or managing the grace of God already given to them. Now, here's why I spend a little time on this. It's also true for us, right? Everything that we need in order to be the church is sitting right here in this room, right? I'm also including our people that are not here today, but you get the point, right? Everything that we need to be the church, everything that we need for the worship of the church, everything that we need to care for the community of the church, everything that we need for the mission of the church is represented in the people. God has already given us the financial gifts and spiritual gifts necessary to be the church in all that he calls us to be. He simply calls us to take some of that treasure and that talent and give it back for the good of others. 1 Peter chapter 4. Verse 10 says, "Each of you should use whatever gift you have received to serve one another as faithful stewards, faithful managers of God's grace in its various forms." So when we give of our treasure, when we give of our talents, we are actually getting to be dispensers of God's grace. It's pretty cool. It's a great privilege. Now, one example of this that I'll give you is our gathered worship on Sundays, which you are here right now. Every Sunday, we erect a tabernacle of sorts where God comes and meets with us, and all of us have a stewardship of this gathering, and it's pretty awesome to watch your stewardship in action on Sundays as we come together in this tabernacle to worship our God. I'll just give you a few numbers related to our Sunday worship. There are 30 volunteers and teachers in Providence Kids every Sunday. They're over there right now, discipling our kids, loving our kids, caring for our kids. The total number of Providence Kids volunteers on the rotation is 144 people. If you're one of those, thank you. Thank you for the way that you give to make worship happen. There are 12 guys on a rotation to help with setup and tear down each week, right? They're the ones that set up the sound system. They put the signs out front. They set up the communion table. Some of them show up early. Some of them stay late. We're so thankful for these guys. If you see a guy carrying one of these big speakers after church on his shoulder like this, because he's really strong, thank him. Thank him for giving of himself that we might worship together. There are 7 or 8 musicians that are up here every week. There's 21 total people on the musician rotation, including those who run sound back there. They pour out their gifts week after week after week, and I'm so glad that they give in this way. What would we do without them? I mean, our music is incredible, is it not? I mean, that third song up here, I was going to cry out, you know, Freebird after that, because I was like, what's going on? There's usually 6 or 8 people serving in hospitality back here, greeting people, welcoming people. Point is, God is using the gifts of his people to make the worship of his people possible, and everyone is needed. Listen, even if you don't have an official role on a Sunday, you're needed because there's no one who's gifted like you. You might have a conversation here that only you can have. Like, you might make a connection with someone that only you can make. You might encourage someone or greet someone in a way that is a divine appointment. And so I want to ask you this. What difference would it make when you walk through those doors if you intentionally saw yourself as a giver? Like, if you prayed on the way over here on Sundays, "God, would you give through me today? God, would you dispense your grace through me?" Can you imagine if all of us walked in the door intentionally thinking, "I'm a giver"? That'd be a worship service. I would come to that regularly. It'd be awesome. So without the gifts of the people, what we see here, there would be no worship of the people. Worship is an us thing. We need each other. Now, that's the gifts. Let's look at the attitude of the people. In other words, what is the posture of their heart toward worship? And I think there's one little section that was just read that's especially revealing, that shows the posture of their heart, their attitude toward worship. Look over in chapter 36, verse 2. This is amazing. 36:2, and Moses called Bezalel and Aholiab and every craftsman in whose mind the Lord had put skill, everyone whose heart stirred him up to come to do the work, and they received from Moses all the contribution that the people of Israel had brought for doing the work of the sanctuary. They still kept bringing him free will offerings every morning. Free will meaning it's not mandatory, right? Free will meaning they don't have to do this. But they continue to do this. Verse 4, so that all the craftsmen who were doing every sort of task on the sanctuary came, each from the tasks that he was doing, and said to Moses, the people bring much more than enough for doing this work that the Lord has commanded us to do. It's almost like the craftsmen are embarrassed by the abundance of everything that's being brought. It's like, this is too much, we don't need all this. Verse 6, so Moses gave command, and the word was proclaimed throughout the camp, let no man or woman do anything more for the contribution for the sanctuary. So the people were restrained from bringing, for the material that they had was sufficient to do all the work and more. Moses had to cut them off. He's like, that is enough, people. No more giving, right? The offering boxes are closed, right? I mean, he would have been a horrible televangelist. Can you imagine? The Lord is telling me right now that we cannot receive any more of your gifts, right? We're taking down the 800 number, right? He's cutting off the giving. Now, a couple of observations about this wonderful scene, and it's a wonderful scene. Number one, the people give voluntarily. They don't have to, they want to. And if you think about it, nothing in their life up to this point has been voluntary. They've been slaves their entire lives. Right? They've had to give, they've had to work, they've had to do at the command of Pharaoh and his taskmasters. But now they have this new master who's a good master, who loves them, who only acts for their good, and they long to serve him. Their heart is overflowing because they're just grateful for his grace toward them. So they give voluntarily, but they also give extravagantly, which I think shows what they really care about, what they really value. Because our money flows to what we love, doesn't it? And so, to them, God is their highest treasure, which means the worship of God is their highest priority. And that's what they want to, they just want to overflow with gifts toward that end. I was reading this week, and for some reason I kept thinking about that old praise chorus. I know it's kind of goofy, but I kept thinking about it. You know, Lord, you're more precious than silver. Lord, you're more costly than gold. Lord, you are more beautiful than diamonds, and nothing I desire compares with you. That's what they're saying. God, I'm so enthralled with who you are that I can't wait to meet with you in the tabernacle as you reveal your presence there, and I'm going to give everything I got towards that. Their heart is overflowing. And so the attitude of the people of God in this text is that they're eager to worship. They're not being coerced. They're not being manipulated. They want to connect with God because it's who they are. It's their identity. It's what they're made for. It's why they were brought out of Egypt in the first place, to be worshipers. Now, in a couple of weeks, the ACL Music Festival will be in town, and it's always a fun time in the life of our city. Thousands upon thousands of people from all over the country will descend upon Zilker Park. And if you think about it, they are worshipers in one sense, meaning they will all gather in one place over there to praise that which they love, and that is music. And when the gates open, they will enter eagerly. Right? Nobody's forcing them to go up there. Right? No one is saying, hey, you had to buy that $250 three-day pass. No one's twisting their arms saying, you got to stand around in the heat and humidity all day, right, and pay way too much for Torchy's tacos. You got to do that. No, they want to do that. And listen, if there's a band there that they really love, Like, if there's a band that maybe they grew up with, it's been around a while, I'm thinking like the Foo Fighters are going to be there for that first Friday night concert. There are going to be some Foo Fighter heads there that are just like grew up with them and love them. If there's that sort of, then those people, they're not going to be late. They're going to be early. They're going to be eager. They're not going to miss a song. They're going to get as close to the stage as possible because that band is part of them, right? Their music, it's part of their story. Their music is deep within them. And they'll be eager to get there. And so as Christians, as I thought about it, that should be the posture of our heart toward worshiping our triune God. Like, we ought to have an attitude of eagerness, an attitude of expectation. Like, we can't wait to do it. Because God is our highest love. Because God is our greatest treasure. Because God is our story, right? And his song is deep within us. And listen, I want you to hear this. I want you to know this. When you show up to worship, when you walk through those doors back there and you enter here, I want you to know that the Father is smiling on you. He is smiling on you in the same way that he smiles on his son Jesus, because he looks at us in the same way that he looks at Jesus. Do you believe that? That when you walk in here, God is beaming because you're here. And he's so proud to be your father. He's so proud that you're his daughter. Or his son. It's like the parable of the prodigal son, the father in that story in Luke 15. He runs out and he can't wait to embrace his son. Why would we not eagerly run toward a God like that, who loves us in that way? Our worship of him should be eager, just like the people here. He's way better than the Foo Fighters, right? I mean, way better. Most things are better than the Foo Fighters. I apologize for even using them as an illustration. All right, we've looked at the gifts of the people, we've looked at the attitude of the people. Let's close by looking at their deepest need. The deepest need of the people in this text is God himself, right? The entire book of Exodus has been showing us that God is their deepest need. Like, their deepest need is not freedom, it's not food, it's not water, it's not land, it's not significance, it's not comfort, it's not security. It's God himself. And through the tabernacle, they're going to have this experience to meet with God in a unique way. It's not that God isn't with them in all the other times and other places of their life, but God will come down in a special way, in a unique way, and meet with them at the tabernacle, because God sets apart the tabernacle to reveal himself uniquely there. Look over at Exodus 29. Exodus 29. We saw these verses last week. Exodus 29, verse 43. He's talking about the tabernacle, the tent of meeting. He says, "There I will meet with the people of Israel, and it shall be sanctified, it shall be set apart by my glory." Where will he meet with them? Well, he will meet with them in this God-designated place called the tabernacle, and it says he will meet with the people corporately and community. Verse 44, "I will consecrate the tent of meeting in the altar," meaning I will set the tent of meeting apart as a special place, as holy ground. "You will worship me on my terms," God is saying, "not your own terms. I will consecrate the tent of meeting and the altar. Aaron also and his sons I will consecrate to serve me as priests. I will dwell among the people of Israel." I want you to listen to how many plural pronouns are in these two verses. I will dwell among the people of Israel, and I will be their God, and they shall know that I am the Lord, their God, who brought them out of the land of Egypt, that I might dwell among them. I am the Lord, their God. All right, see, God dwells right in the middle of his people corporately, and the tabernacle is this visible witness to that fact. So their worship is primarily communal. It's a community affair. It's not private, because worship is an us thing. Now, here's what's interesting. The New Testament takes this Old Testament imagery of the tabernacle and makes a direct link or a direct connection to our corporate worship as Christians today. If you have a Bible, look over at Hebrews. I got to show you this. This is so great. Hebrews chapter 10. Just go towards the end of the Bible, and when you get to Revelation, back up like 20 pages, and you'll be in Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 10. I was just having my devotional time this week, and I read this. I wasn't even looking for this. So great. God does that. Hebrews chapter 10. I want you to see the connection with the tabernacle here. Hebrews 10, verse 19. Therefore, brothers, since we have confidence to enter the holy places by the blood of Jesus. Remember last week we talked about the tabernacle, and we said there's two rooms in the tabernacle. The holy place was the front of it, and then the most holy place that was divided by a veil. You couldn't come into either, not everybody, only the priest could come into those holy places. What this is saying is that through Jesus, by his blood, all of us have access to the real holy place. We can approach God. Pretty cool. Verse 20, by a new and living way that he has opened for us through the curtain, through the veil that we used to not be able to come through, that is through his flesh. And since we have a great high priest, that is Jesus, over the house of God, let us draw near. So we can draw near God now with a true heart and full assurance of faith, with our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. So now we can draw near being cleansed, like at the depth of our conscience. Like we can come in here with a clean conscience. It's amazing, even though God knows everything about us. In verse 23, let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. Now look at this connection he makes starting in verse 24. And let us together consider how we may stir up one another to love and good works, not neglecting to meet together, as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day drawing near. So what he's saying here is that we can freely approach God now, but hey, don't forget to stir one another up. Don't forget to meet together. Don't forget to encourage one another. So apparently there's this one another component to meeting God. There's this one another component to worshiping God that you can't do without. Now, just like the Israelites, our deepest need is God. Our deepest need is to connect with God, to meet with God, to be renewed by God. And he has provided in his grace a weekly time that we might meet with him in a special way. And I said this last week, but it's not like God doesn't meet with us. It's not like God's with us, not with us in all the other places and times during our week. But God has chosen to meet with us in the gathering of his people in a unique way, in a powerful way, in a very particular way. Listen, gathered worship is a purposefully organized encounter with the living God that you can't get anywhere else. Let me say that again. Gathered worship is a purposefully organized encounter with the living God that you cannot get anywhere else. Just as the tabernacle was purposefully organized, it had a pattern to it, so our worship has a pattern to it. It's the same pattern every week. Now, our worship is different every week, and yet it follows the same pattern, and you see it there in your liturgy. An easy way to remember our pattern for worship is to remember these five C's: the call to worship, the confession, then the middle of the service, which what we would call the consecration, meaning we are consecrated to God by his word, communion, and then commissioning or benediction, ascending out. So in the call to worship, God initiates, right? He convenes this meeting. He speaks first. We give him the first word because he gets us together. If you miss the call to worship, by the way, it's not like missing the previews before a movie. It's like missing the first 10 minutes of the movie because that's part of the story. Then there's confession. God, we come into the presence of a holy God. We realize our own sin, and we realize I got to come clean. And by the way, I can be cleansed. And we're reminded of that cleansing, that forgiveness each week through the sacrifice of Jesus. And then consecration. God sets us apart as his people through his word. Faith in his word, obedience to his word. And so we profess our faith together. The scripture is read each week. The scripture is preached each week. You get to sit under the word of God at gathered worship in ways that you don't in any other venue in your life. And then communion. God gives us a physical sign, a sacrament, a God-ordained sacrament to remind us that he loves us, that we belong to him. And we get to experience it together. We come down front and we're nourished on his grace together. And then finally, commissioning. That's the benediction. God blesses us, and he sends us out to be a blessing. That is the pattern for worship. God gathers his people. God renews his people. God sends them out. And then next week, he does it again. God gathers his people. God renews his people. God sends them out. That's how God has always done it with his people. Every church does that in different ways, but that's essentially what's happening in the gathered worship of God's people wherever you go to church. That's the pattern. It's his chosen means of meeting with his people. Now, I want to say something that's potentially going to make a few of you mad at me, and that's okay. All right, I figure I got to risk that every now and then, right? Or else I'm not doing my job very well. I know that for some of you, if you're honest with yourself, gathered worship is not a top priority in your life, right? In other words, it's a maybe thing, not a definitely thing, right? It's one option in your list of weekend options. But, you know, if something comes up, you know, if the Cowboy game is on, which it's on right now, if you got a chance to go to the lake, if a kid has a soccer game or a kid needs to take a nap or you're working on a house project, you don't feel like going, it might just kind of get the boot because it's just one option. I want to exhort you, which means I want to strongly encourage you to begin to move in the direction to make gathered worship a priority in your life, part of who you are, part of your identity, no matter where you are, to begin taking steps towards making it a part of who you are for your good, right? Because your greatest need is God. And God meets with you in a unique way in gathered worship in a way that he doesn't in other places. The reason, listen to this, the reason we make a commitment to gathered worship as Christians is not because going to church makes us more righteous. It doesn't. Jesus is our righteousness. The reason we make a commitment to going to gathered worship as Christians is not because going to church is always awesome. It's not. Sometimes it's pretty average. You might be thinking that right now. Sometimes we don't feel anything at all. We make a commitment as Christians to the gathered worship of the church because our commitments have a way of forming us and shaping us as people. In fact, the things in your life that you are most faithful to, they form you, they shape your identity more than any other thing. It's the old saying, we make our commitments, and then our commitments make us, don't they? An example of this in my own family is our family dinner at our house. We try to eat dinner around the table as a family a few nights a week. It's not every night, but we try to do it a few times a week. And I got to tell you, it has not gotten easier to do this as my kids have gotten older. Because, you know, there's just more stuff going on. There's just more reasons to let it slide. And sometimes we think to ourselves, you know what? It might be easier if we just, like, left the food out and then people can just eat on their own schedule and eat in their own room or just eat whenever they want. But we don't do that because the point of a family dinner is not eating. Right? The point of family dinner is eating together. And we've made a commitment to do it. Not because it's always awesome. Sometimes it's real average. Right? Sometimes we get in fights at the table. But we've made that commitment, and we've seen that commitment has started to form us as a family, because this ongoing commitment has a way of being a rhythm that forces us to stop, even if it's like for 15, 20 minutes, and to remember who we are. And to remember whose we are. We belong to one another. See how that works? See, as Christians, we could say, you know, it doesn't really matter if I go to church. I'll catch the podcast later. I'll catch up. But the point of gathered worship is not to download content, right? The point of gathered worship is to be together in the presence of God, to worship God together. That's why we do it. I'll end with these two verses. 1 Corinthians 3:16. Do you not know that you, and it's you plural here, y'all, are God's temple, his tabernacle, and God's spirit dwells in y'all? See what that's saying? You together are the tabernacle. You together are the meeting place of God. You are where God comes down and meets when you're together. Ephesians 2:21. In Christ, you, y'all, are being built together into a dwelling place for God by the Spirit. In other words, you together are the tabernacle, the meeting place of God. How awesome is that? That is amazing that through the death and the resurrection of Jesus, God doesn't just save us out of sin and death, he saves us into a people. And then God dwells in the midst of that people, and we get to be a part of that. See, worshiping together is just living into that reality that Jesus has already secured for us. Worship is an us thing. Let's thank him.
Thanks for listening to the podcast of Providence Church. For more resources and info, visit us online at www.providenceaustin.com.